for 6 gallons of root beer syrup. Valentine got a White Fang guide to take him up to St. Louis, the grog clearing a path through the brush with a year-old legwork. His guide would frequently stop his mount to scout on foot, and at these rests, Valentine would feed the horses and check their trail. The only thing that picked them up was a slight cold on their ride north. Both he and his guide took turns sneezing and blowing their noses, but it was better when they came into St. Louis 3 days later. Valentine had traded a captured revolver. He tinkered with it on the journey and modified the grip and trigger guard for grog-sized fingers for a foot pass and toted his bag full of toys to Blake's home. Not that Blake lacked toys. The old Jesuit researcher, Kutcher, had been observing him constantly as he played with various puzzles, games, and toys, gauging the young Reaper's mental development. They'd built another coop and chicken run in the side yard of the prairie-style house, located high on the bluffs above the Missouri. The Owl Eye Grogs had added a rock pile at either side of the driveway. According to the scratchings, this was a place of powerful good magic for the tribe. He gave some bolts of cloth, seeds, and religious books to Narcisse. Along with her care of Blake, she'd started a little church for the human community in St. Louis. While the only holy spirit the human river traders took came in a square bottle, Narcisse had made it her specialty to invite human captives of the Grogs into her circle. She'd been traveling to a couple of different neighborhoods, more or less strapped to a mule. Valentine would have to promote his pack horse to the carriage trade and find her a little two-wheel cart. He could acquire the kind of thing high-ranking Grog chieftain wives used to visit relatives in the complicated tribal family structure, curtained to prevent the lowlier Grogs from gazing on the high and mighty. Valentine pulled the bell rope that told Blake that it was okay to come out of his comfortable basement room.
Papa!
Blake, at just under 4 years, was as tall as a boy on the cusp of his teens. He wore an oversized jacket and jeans with the cuffs extended. Gloves dangled from his sleeves. When he'd go outside, he'd add a scarf and a floppy old hat to disguise his appearance.
Wobble, happy to see you! Night games tonight?
Anything you like. Fishing, a deer run, or I can read you stories.
Night games!
For night games, Blake wore a football helmet with padding sewn in at the sides so it fit snugly on his rather narrow head. The games took place in the old St. Louis Children's Museum, a warren of chutes and ladders and tunnels made out of assorted bits of industrial and artistic junk from the pre-2022 world. The Grogs used it to train young warriors. At night, the Grogs loosed their young on each other to chase and brawl. Some of the tougher human children sometimes joined in, also suitably padded and helmeted. Blake's helmet had a mesh with eyelets attached to the grill. Valentine once explained to another human parent that the Grogs sometimes gouged with their long fingers, and with leather gloves on, it would be hard to distinguish him from any other skinny young boy. There were no human kids there the night he took Blake. Valentine relaxed a little. Blake sometimes liked to show off by executing a jump no human could make, and sometimes when wrestling, he reversed his arm joints. The most common Grog game was for one of the less dominant males to run up and swat a tougher one and then try to get away. The Grog children clearly considered it something of a coup if they could get away from Blake. They would swing or dangle from climbing obstacles and hit him, or three would strike at once and run off in different directions. Blake took the punches and swats with good humor and pursued his attackers and threw and pinned them when he could. The roughhousing resulted in surprisingly few injuries. Young Grogs bounced like basketballs. Valentine had stiffened the mesh in front of Blake's chin. Blake had acquired a good deal of self-control, but no sense taking chances. He sat, watching Blake play. When Blake disappeared into one of the ill-lit buildings filled with noise and shadow, he followed, carrying a mug of sweet tea hot from a thermos. A second thermos waited in Valentine's pack for when Blake tired. It was filled with warm chicken blood. The next day, they crossed into the woods on the north side of the Missouri for an early morning deer run. Blake didn't have his helmet this time, just a hat with ear flaps. Valentine and Blake had a unique manner of deer hunting. They'd cover their scent as best they could with deer droppings and then wait. The deer liked to forage at the edges of old roads and broken-up parking lots. When they decided the herd was close enough, Valentine would tap Blake, and they would take off after a deer.
Go!
Last time they'd gone on a deer run, Valentine had been able to sprint ahead of Blake, even with his stiff leg. This time, Blake beat him early in their dash after the bouncing white tails. Sometimes the deer crisscrossed and Blake got confused, but this time he bounded towards a big young buck at the fringe. Valentine had a moment's doubt, wondering if Blake would be taken for a brief ride before he lost his grip, but he brought it down like a cougar, clawing his way onto its neck and biting. By the time he trotted up to Blake, the deer's eyes had gone dead and sightless. Blake raised a blood-smeared smile to him.
Clean kill, Blake. Let's dress it. Sissy will have venison for the whole winter now. Or deer sausage to go with her eggs.
At noon, Blake liked to sleep through the days. Valentine settled him down for a nap. They'd return with the deer carried on a pole between them that night. He read to Blake a little from Charlotte's Web, but Blake seemed unimpressed by Wilbur's predicament.
Pigs don't talk. Story's not real.
It's a story. In stories, pigs can talk. So can spiders and rats.
Blake didn't understand why, if the pig could talk to Templeton or Charlotte A. Kavatica, it couldn't talk to Fern. Blake would rather watch the bugs moving in the grasses and find out what they were doing. Maybe he was just scientifically minded. Valentine still found it disturbing that he couldn't summon his imagination to aid him in understanding the story. The next day, Valentine watched Blake with Narcisse. She touched Blake frequently, patting him on the head or shoulder or arm, and he smiled, but he rarely touched or returned hugs with much enthusiasm. But then he loved to nap with his head pillowed on her lap or breast. Once, while Blake was sleeping away the morning, Valentine sat over coffee with Narcisse.
Are you ever afraid?
David, don't be silly. I am safer with the boy here than with a whole pack of guard dogs. He tells me when the grogs come, 10 minutes before I hear them.
No, I mean of Blake.
He cares in his way. He is like the cat who just take affection on his terms. One time, I fell from my wheel stool, and before I knew it, he was beside me and righted it. After, I had a scrape on my arm, and he got a cloth with vinegar for it.
Maybe he thought he was repairing you the way he did the chicken wire.
One night in August, it was hot, and I did not kiss him goodnight. He asked me why I didn't as I left, and I told him I was worried that he was getting too big for a kiss goodnight. He said he liked it because it made him feel warm and sleepy. He has love and caring. Do not worry for me.
They said their goodbyes in the driveway. The garage now had a two-wheeled rig for Valentine's pack horse. Wobble sniffed at the new feed trough Valentine had built. Narcisse had shown herself adept at driving the trap, and Blake found the challenge of driving a horse fascinating. Blake approved of simple action-result loops much more than E.B. White. Valentine had acquired the rig by pledging to a loan of trade goods at the old church office in the city. He'd pay it back through the river rats.
No sneaking blood out of that horse now, Blake.
No, Pops.
Help Sissy all you can. I may be gone for a while, so you gotta look out for her.
No trouble for Sissy.
Narcisse stroked Blake's odd tufts of hair. It looked as though someone had glued old toothbrush heads in odd patterns on his scalp. It just grew in that way. He remembered one of the Miskatonic researchers saying something about it possibly being an identifying mark.
Oh, go with the magic of the right hand, David.
David plucked Narcisse out of her wheelchair and hugged her. She'd put on a little weight since he'd met her in Haiti.
Can't thank you enough, Sissy.
I go where the most need is. Blake needs someone to teach him. My whole life, I never fit in anywhere. That is something I can teach Blake. How not to fit in right. The people here, especially the captive of the Grog, they need me too.
Valentine knew Narcisse had been practicing her folkloric brand of medicine with the humans. She had turned a sunny south breakfast nook into a room devoted to growing herbs. How she got exotic peppers and roots in St. Louis was a marvel. Kutcher had probably helped her build her collection. He was proud of the victories he'd won for the cause, but he couldn't visit Big Rock Hill again without seeing faces of Beck and Kessie, knowing where they were buried and what they looked like before they'd been cleaned and shrouded. Narcisse was also a victory, in a way. There'd never been a plaque to commemorate her, the way there was one on the old red brick consular residence on Big Rock. Instead of brass lettering, the victory came with a shining smile, a colorful kerchief, and arms he could feel as they embraced. Yeah! He rode away from the house in the Missouri Bluffs and into a cold wind. He didn't dare think of it as home, or else he'd never have left it. Back at the high beam assembly, Valentine found his company hard at work sewing. He had changed back into the tired old militia uniform and ordered a powdered meal as he received Rand's report. A contingent of 3 aged wolves had arrived. They were already known through the company as Patel's Shepherds. Each had taken a platoon and were putting them through tough field training. Rand took off his glasses and cleaned them with his shirt tail as he closed out his formal report.
Recon's hard at work. They've sniffed out 6 stills, 2 basement markets, 3 gambling dens, and a brothel and a smokehouse that does beef sticks you won't believe. They also located a mother and 2 talented widowed sisters in Jonesboro who enjoy giving formal dinner parties for the handsome, brave young officers of Southern Command. Handsome and young being key to an invitation to dinner. In other words, they're experienced soldiers.
Valentine found his desk unusually orderly. He'd been expecting an overflowing in-basket.
Private Ediac, the gal with the idea for the uniforms, helped me with some of the low-priority stuff. The rest is in the locked file cabinet.
They'd set up 2 sewing machines in a workshop next to the command tent. Someone had found a battery-operated lamp and hung it high in the tent. He met Private Ediac, a small blonde with the delicately wide-eyed look of someone brought up on KZ rations when she had a soldier model the uniform. It was made out of denim, the color of a foggy evening. Padded at the knees, baggy about the legs, but easily bloused into boots. She'd layered a denim jacket over an athletic sweatshirt and put an olive canvas utility vest over that. The vest was trimmed with yellow reflective tape. Valentine recognized the vests. They were labor regiment. He used to cram sandwiches and water bottles into the big pockets for a day in the fields or on the roads. There were D-rings for holding more gear on this version. He walked around the soldier modeling the uniform. He looked like a young, fit construction worker.
The Dayglo tape is almost out at supply, Major Valentine. I backed it with fabric and Velcro. Removing the reflective stuff just takes a second. Speaking of Velcro, sir, the same goes for the arm patches. If it would be possible for us to get something made that looks KZ-ish, we could swap between KZ and Southern Command as needed.
I wondered about that too, sir. The Inspector General's office won't like flags not being sewn on. These colors don't run, and all that.
The Inspector General's never had to look inconspicuous in a KZ streetcar, Rand. Who's the honcho there now?
General Martinez. 3 Hots Martinez, the men call him.
Valentine's stomach went sour at the name, but there was no need and no time to pick at old scabs. He offered his hand to Ediac.
Good work, Ediac. You just won yourself a promotion to corporal. You're also company clerk, if you want the job.
Clerk, sir?
It's a quick path up to lieutenant's bars, if you'd like to start that climb again.
I'll do it, sir.
Good. Your first job will be to requisition whatever you need to finish these uniforms. I'll speak to someone about getting us some KZ patches.
The someone Valentine had in mind was Lambert and her staff. Valentine rather liked being able to dump such details off on someone who could be relied on to get it done.
What about helmets and rain gear, sir?
Typically, these formations wear white or yellow hard hats, sir.
Let's see if we can scrounge up some civilian winter coats. I don't ever remember seeing these guys in ponchos. As for helmets, maybe we can stuff some old hard hats with Kevlar. Get canvas covers for when we don't want the Dayglo look.
Patrol coming in.
You expecting a patrol, Lieutenant Rand?
Patel's Shepherds have been taking them out, platoon at a time on overnighters or 3-dayers, sir. This should be 1st platoon coming back from a 3-dayer.
Valentine went out to take a look. The platoon looked dog-tired and strained. rolling on their feet in the toe-in manner of foot-sore men, as they carried sand-filled artillery shell casings instead of guns. A grizzled wolf sergeant led the way, saluting as he marched past. Valentine saw some bandages across noses and a few blackened eyes.
Sergeant, halt!
Line up for inspection!
Valentine saw Corporal Glass at the other end discreetly check the line. Valentine took a look at one of the bandages.
What happened here, Sergeant?
We paused at a roadside for fresh pretzel bread and beverages, sir. The gentleman owning the establishment didn't care for script. We convinced him otherwise.
Anything serious?
Valentine doubted the road stop in question would make a report. Everyone was required to take Southern Command script, but some business owners didn't care for the exchange rates.
One of them drew a knife, sir. The civilian in question will be working his fly with his left hand for a while. Corporal Glass has a good eye. He's quick, or I might not be standing here.
Good work, 1st Platoon. Get some food and sleep.
Yes, sir. 1st Platoon, move out!
Left! Left! Left, right, left!
Valentine fell back into the training regime as the days turned grim and gray and the nights cold. They'd formalized the roster at last and had three balanced platoons. Valentine had known companies where there was a crack platoon that took the toughest jobs and two less reliable ones to support it. But he'd rather distribute his best men where they could teach the others than rely too much on a single elite formation. The NCO slots were filled with ex-Quislings. He gave them a brief speech about duty, as he saw it. In the KZ, command flowed down, with a lurking or else implicit at the end of every order. While that was a fact of military life, regardless of origin and uniform, Valentine would rather have those under his command following orders because they understood the stakes and consequences of failure. Several of them turned down offers of promotion to leadership roles. That was the big shortcoming of these men, he'd learned. They could use their equipment, but not their minds. Everyone was terrified of making a bad decision, lest they be out of seat when the next round of musical chairs orchestrated by the Reapers came round. Soldiering wasn't for the dumb. Not if you wanted good soldiers rather than gun-toting robots. They held a company party at Christmas, with everyone in their smoky denim uniforms and the kind of glossy shine you could get with new boots. The base hall was being used by the guards, so Valentine spoke to the pastor of a local church and got the use of a big revival tent, complete with a deacon to open the ceremonies and offer a Christmas homily. The company made paper lanterns and fire balloons and put up a Christmas tree in front of the command shack. A distribution of quality flour, confectioner's sugar, and food coloring allowed the foodies in the company to make green and red iced cupcakes. With a couple of guitarists, a fiddler, and Rand, who turned out to be an accomplished hurdy-gurdy player, he claimed he was always too clumsy to dance, so he might as well play for others. They held a dance. Valentine paid a visit to the hospital in Jonesboro to issue a general invitation to the nurses there. A handful were brave enough to show, and a few brought friends. Valentine issued strict orders not to talk about the move south, no matter how pretty the face or how good the reason for future correspondence.
You might as well get to know them. Some of us are going to end up seeing a lot of nurses before the operation's over.
Valentine enjoyed the opening tune with the senior nurse chaperoning her charges. The nurse had a lot of experience dancing with a man with a stiff leg, and then settled down with Patel to watch the festivities and make sure the punch bowl wasn't spiked to over 80 proof. The smiles on the faces of the soldiers and nurses cheered him more than the music. The company had worked hard on their uniforms and decorations, and he liked seeing them show off a little.
Yeah!
We brung you a Christmas present, Major. New recruits? You was looking for some grogs.
They'll fit right in with the shit detail.
A grog sprawled for a second, then stood up, and a second was pulled in right behind. But Valentine couldn't take his eyes from the third. She was a female gray, dressed in an oversized pink tutu and fake ballet slippers. It was the grog he'd once known as B.
B?
B!
The grog stared back, eyes open wide and staring. She tried to slink sideways up next to him. Most of the men there had never heard grog speak intelligibly, let alone speak other than when wounded and begging for assistance. Valentine locked his gaze on the joker who'd called them the shit detail.
What did you call this company, guard?
Nothing, sir.
Boys, these visitors seem to be confused as to the location of their barrack. Escort them back.
shit, let's go!
Let's get out of here!
The guards wisely dropped the grog chains and ran, with half the company in hot pursuit, throwing Christmas cupcakes. The male grogs behind B fell to their knees and covered their heads with their hands as men hurtled them. B dragged herself up to Valentine.
It's all right. I've got you.
Valentine took B, the other two, and a plate of cupcakes over to the workshop tent. He issued cupcakes, knowing most grogs had a sweet tooth. The other two grogs had eyed him with suspicion first, but that had been broken by B's emphatic thumping of Valentine's chest, a grog version of saying he's a stand-up guy, evidently. Hoffman Price, the bounty hunter B traveled with, was dead, evidently of some illness. He'd made it into free territory and turned B over to an old friend before dying during a surgery B didn't begin to understand. The old friend, whom B called Whitehair, promptly dropped dead a short time after Price. Whitehair's family either gave or sold B to a circus. That's where she met the other two grogs, Ford and Chevy. They'd been warriors from a tribe in Mississippi who crossed the river in some incursion and were left behind, wounded. They were captured, defanged, they pointed to the big gaps in their teeth, and bought by the DC Marvel Circus. They didn't know the name of the circus. Valentine had guessed it. He'd seen posters put up around the hospital giving the dates for the circus performances at the Jonesboro Fairgrounds. According to the men, it was mostly a set of rigged carnival games and bad ginger ales sold for $3 a bottle. A beer that was all head cost $6.
They make be, make dance, make fall, make roll.
In the circus, Bee performed what Valentine guessed to be a comic ballet in her tutu. The other two took turns standing in an empty kiddie pool while spectators threw rotten onions and tomatoes at them. He ordered a couple of buckets of warm soapy water, a sponge, and towels. First thing to do was get them cleaned up and Bee out of that ridiculous tutu.
You want finished circus?
Yes! Yes! No more! No more! Please!
Like join Thin Skin's warrior tribe?
Not warriors. Us finished warriors.
Chevy pointed to the gaps in his dental work and hung his head towards the floor. It was a matter of great shame among the grogs, but Valentine couldn't care less.
Not matter with Thin Skins.
The men didn't much care for having grogs among them. The former quislings considered the troops who fought using grogs the lowest of the low, hardly human themselves. Discontent filtered up through the sergeants and to Patel.
Yes, the Kurian Zone despises them. Southern Command hates them. But a uniformed grog can cross a bridge or stand at a crossroads without anyone looking at him twice in the Kurian Zone. I'm sure you can see the use of that.
Yes, sir.
We're going to have to put him under someone. Any ideas?
Why don't we just call them the Major's Bodyguard?
That's a bit Lawrence of Arabia for me. Anyone who does it gets a quick promotion. That is how they entice people to do it in the KZ.
Let's put them under glass. It's not so much that he likes grogs. I just think he hates people more.
You won't believe it's outside, Major. It's quite a show.
Valentine could believe it. A civilian stood at the gate, a rather dazzling bronzed man in a purple tailcoat and oversized yellow bow tie. He'd been half expecting this. He went to the corner of the shack and took a tin plate off a bucket he'd been saving for just such an occasion. He filled his pockets. Valentine closed the top button on his old militia tunic. He wanted the men to have their uniforms finished before they made his, and stepped out to the top step of the command shack.
Is that him?
Yes, sir.
Hello, Major. DC Marvels is the name. Dazzling cavalcades of marvels is my game. You heard of me?
Not until recently.
Then I'd like to extend my personal invitation to the show. You're aware that soldiers are entitled to a 10% discount at my circus, 20% on food and beverages, for parties of three or more, that is.
How can I help you, Mr. Marvels?
There's been some sort of misunderstanding. A few of your gallant comrades rented an attraction of mine. A poor, benighted grogs I've taken under my wing, saving them from river dredging, or worse. They never returned. I'm due in Mountain Home by the end of the week.
I don't see where I fit in. Were they men under my command?
Well, I didn't say you were responsible, Major. The soldiers in question said things got rather out of hand at your party, and they had to leave my attractions behind. Grogs can't be left in the hands of amateurs. They'll sicken and die, poor things.
I'm afraid they've quit your circus, Mr. Marvels. They've enlisted with Southern Command.
Huh. You're kidding, right? They're not competent. They're mine, and I want them back. I'm trying to be nice here, but I'm perfectly willing to take legal action.
So am I. Get off this post.
Oh, this is nonsense. Ford! Jimmy! B! Here now!
Cut it out, Marvels.
When I see my property.
The ripe tomato struck Marvels just under the yellow tie. Valentine drew a rotten onion from his other back pocket.
That's assault! You've assaulted a civilian! I'll have your commission for this!
Then I might as well enjoy myself. The gate's that way, Marvels. Hit the road!
The expected summons to Colonel Singh's office came that very afternoon, courtesy of Singh's messenger, Tittle. Tittle reminded Valentine of the White Rabbit, or maybe the Roadrunner, always in a hurry to get somewhere. He either ran or used a light motorbike rigged with tires for cross-country driving. His hair normally looked as though he'd had a recent close encounter with a live wire. Valentine had washed up with some of his French soap and put on his best uniform. Colonel Singh didn't look particularly jolly.
That Marvels fellow just left. He's in quite a temper.
Is he getting his grogs back?
No. I pointed out that the practice of chattel slavery is against the law and is, in fact, a hanging offense. He said I could expect a letter from his lawyer. I don't need these headaches, Valentine.
Sorry, sir. He had two of those grogs in what amounts to a bear-baiting pit. Customers paid to throw fruit at them. Says much about some of the customers as it does about Marvels. If he starts a legal fight, it might be worth someone's while to check his payroll accounts. When I had Anka on my rolls, I kept up to date with policy. They're free to hire on or quit, and you have to pay them at least convict rate. According to the grogs, they never saw so much as a dollar.
Still not a defense for your behavior. Save it for the enemy, Valentine.
Valentine smiled at that. Technically, he was still a condemned man under Southern Command's fugitive law, though his face had long since been removed from the wanted cabinets.
Will that be all, Colonel?
No, Major. Lambert told me you were a little unorthodox, but effective. Let's work on the effective and cut down on the unorthodox. Now, why aren't ordinary militia uniforms good enough for your men?
You want us to operate in the Kurian zone. Southern Command militia uniforms might be a bit of a giveaway.
Still, it's odd.
It's an odd unit with an odd role. Supply in enemy territory, acting as liaison with the local resistance.
Yet from what I've seen, you're training your company like you're part of the Hunter Battalion.
You don't object to fitness trials, I hope, sir.
We'll see what kind of man you have when the real training starts in January. I'll look forward to seeing what you can do.
The guns arrived a few days after the unpleasant meeting.
Damn.
It was hard not to be disappointed. They viewed them from the back of the wagon rig, three cases of rifles and one of pistols. A trio of Uzi-style submachine guns were in with the pistols, evidently meant for the officers. The rest were mostly militia stuff, deer rifles and shotguns, and a few venerable AR-15s. In the hands of a company of veteran wolves, it could be a deadly enough assortment, but he wondered if they'd be heavy, expensive noisemakers in the hands of some of the greener members of his company. It would make familiarization and training a nightmare. Plus, there would be supply difficulties trying to get everything from buckshot to .358 to .30-06 to .223 caliber into individual hands. Valentine turned to see Sergeant Major Patel shake his head sadly as he surveyed a double-barreled bird gun.
It's like telling the men they can't be trusted with anything better.
Valentine thought a couple of the Remingtons might make decent sniper rifles if they could find optics. He had at least 6 trained scout snipers out of the Kurian services. They had an easier time sneaking away than most. A shotgun or 2 distributed to each squad would be handy for urban use. The rest, not much more than rabbit guns, would be better off in the hands of the UFR's young camp scouts or backwoods raccoon hunters. There was nothing to do but hand them out.
Gotta be kidding.
Maybe these are just a carry for practice weight, like the shells.
We should take a trip over to the River Patrol Reserve Armory between the Tennessee and the Mississippi. They don't hardly guard that. Get us some real guns.
Private Rawlings, what's that?
Sorry, sir.
No, you're not in trouble. Come over here.
Yes, Major?
What did you say about an armory?
River Patrol Armory and Motor Pool, sir. The old Western Kentucky, number 4. We used to gas up there when I was with the River Road Light Artillery of the Tennessee Troop. It's a CRAP, or CRP. Combined River Patrol, sir. Reserve Armory and Warehouse for patrol and artillery boats in the Tennessee, Ohio, and the Mississippi. Creepy place. There's those flappy gargoyles quartered in town and nests of harpies in the hills up by the Ohio.
Explain what you mean about unguarded.
Well, not unguarded. There's usually 6 or 7 men about. It's just that the armory is for the River Patrol, so the Tennessee Troop, they don't see it as their job to garrison it. The River Patrol figures that since it's inland, it's the troop's job to secure it. Nobody wants to be stationed there exactly with the harpies in the hills and the gargoyles in the empty town. Not much to do but play cards and come up with better nose plugs.
Rawlings had 5 more uncomfortable minutes as Valentine quizzed him about the roads in the area, the terrain, the location of KZ settlements. When he finished, the poor private was sweating. Valentine gripped him on the shoulder.
Thank you, Rawlings. You're the kind of complainer I like.
How's that, sir?
The kind that offers a solution.
The wilderness of eastern Kentucky, New Year's Eve, the 54th year of the Kurian Order. With the sun and orange and purple bruise along the western skyline, Harpy Country wakes up. There's something odd about this particular Grog territory. The kudzu on old utility poles and lines grows thick on every sunstruck prominence in a twisted tendril game of King of the Hill that dares you to contest its ownership. Thicker stands of wood have a bat cave smell, with nothing thriving in the shade but thistle and thorn and tree-hugging fungus looking like suppurating wounds. The few highways cut through Harpy lands are barely open, the vegetation kept back only by the big machines that occasionally claw through the potholed roads. The devastation from the New Madrid quake has never been repaired. Whole communities are nothing but heaps of rubble with a vine-covered wall or chimney still standing. Binoculars just made the warehouse and truck yard look worse. In the dark from a distance, Valentine could see the armory was only 3 buildings. 2 of cinder block, linked by a nicer brick office, forming an uneven U lit at the doors by tired bulbs that looked like they wanted to surrender to the night. With the aid of the binoculars, Valentine's night eyes picked out peeling paint, the tires and blocks holding down plastic sheeting on the roofs, and the plywood nailed over the windows. Patel and Hoboken, the youngest of Patel's shepherds, looked at it with him. The ad hoc raid had come together as though it were a natural, expected event, like a birth. When Valentine proposed the operation at a scheduled meeting, he met initial resistance in the form of a frown and a shake of Colonel Singh's head, but Moitana and the Bear Lieutenant Gamecock both came to assistance, claiming that their men were fretting, wanting either leave or an operation. They could have both by joining in the raid, as hunters back from the KZ traditionally enjoyed at least a 3-day pass, if not a 21 in Southern Command's vernacular. Valentine had argued that the rest of the brigade might be reassured by a quick successful strike into the Kurian zone and a return across the Mississippi, and Singh gave his approval. Valentine turned in his written plan the very same evening and started on the orders for the company the next morning. As Rand had organized transport, Valentine received an unexpected visitor.
Morning, Major.
Gamecock had thick hair on the arms projecting from his sleeveless shirt and wore the first legworm leather pants Valentine had seen since he lost his rig in Pacific Command. Most officers in Southern Command knew better than to lecture bears on proper attire. He carried a flour sack over his shoulder with one arm and gave Valentine a casual salute with his free hand.
Okay to talk about the op, sir?
Go ahead.
This scheme of yours, you're going to be a Quisling Grog officer.
Yes.
Yeah, I was gonna trade what's in this here flower sack to a sorry excuse of a guard captain in exchange for a case of Canadian scotch, but it's turning my stomach to see the guy who held a big rock walking around with an old single-shot militia rifle. Got it off a Quisling lieutenant colonel with matching tooling on his belt, hat, and boots. Even dead, he looked like a show night fag, but he knew his hardware.
Valentine extracted a gleaming submachine gun and a screw-on tube as long as the gun itself. It had odd lines. The barrel was pitched on a bias different from the frame. He picked it up and extended the handle just under the muzzle.
That's an Atlanta buzzsaw, model 18 select entry model. Limited production run, elites and officers only. That cockeyed barrel's there for a purpose. The bolt's at an angle, so recoil keeps the muzzle from climbing off target. Pretty accurate one-handed, even on full auto. No selector switch, you can tap them out single shot with light pulls. Going over to full auto, you just pull the trigger all the way. She'll group under a meter at 100 paces. That silencer there is something I rigged.
9mm Parabellum.
I know, a little light for stopping a Reaper in full charge. I threw in some boxes of silver points. Team Fumaroles had good results with them. They don't flatten out against Reaper cloth so much.
I don't suppose you've got any quickwood bullets.
And we got a box of 7.62 for the whole team, sir. One lousy box. Production problems. Wish they'd tell me where the trees were. I'd make myself some friggin' steaks.
I'll show you one personally when we get back. Assuming some farmer hasn't cut it down for tomato steaks. But by the way, where's the accent from?
South Carolina born. First name's Scotty, sir.
Val will do from now on, when things are less formal. Grateful to you, Scotty.
Grateful to you, sir. My boys are ready to kill each other. Only three things will keep a bear quiet if there's no fighting going on. Sleeping, eating, and, well,
screwing. Lieutenant Nail and the old Razors put it a little more colorfully.
Yeah. Any case, sir, we've all put on 10 pounds and everyone's caught up on sack time. I got all I can do to keep the women and chickens around here safe.
Now, the bears and most of the wolves were employed in a strike at a collection of river patrol docks and blockhouses on Island 10, while a short platoon of Valentine's company, escorted by a striking team of wolves, targeted the armory. The rest of his command remained at either side of the Mississippi under Rand, blowing up rubber boats and improvised rafts called ping-pong ball miracles in preparation for the trip back. The trip across and the movement to the armory had gone off well, with the Skeeter fleet bringing them across just before dawn on New Year's Eve, their camouflage-painted twin outboard boats growling into the muddy Mississippi waters like dogs giving the angry warning that comes before the leap. Valentine's hand-picked team of 20, B, and the Wolves had paralleled the east-west highway heading into Mayfield, Kentucky, and then turned north into the Grog Country, the Wolves out front and behind and flanking, continually restoring contact like sheepdogs with a flock. They had taken advantage of a chilling rain to make good time down the road, which had deteriorated into a rutted trail. According to Rawlings, no one who counted lived up this way, in a region of low sandy hills and scrub forest. River patrol supply trucks and grog recruiters were all that used the roads meeting at the armory. The armory had old-fashioned bars around it, linking cement columns. Valentine wondered if something more ostentatious had once stood on the other side of the fence. This was like garlanding a turd.
No Curian towers around here, right, Rawlings?
No, sir. None that I know about. Never met any Reapers on the river road that way, but I never went into the Harpy Woods, though.
Well, if they are out there, they can surprise us.
He, Rawlings, and B approached from the east down the tree-throttled road, three wolves trailing through cover behind. Valentine carried his 18 select in a battered leather courier pouch filled with a meaningless assortment of captured paperwork. Valentine smelled harpies on the cold wind blowing down from the northwest. As they approached the gate, he slipped on the brass ring he'd won in Seattle. He didn't like to wear the thing.
Is that what I think it is, Major?
Yes.
You take it off
It's a long story. Shit.
Behind the doghouse was a line of trucks and a wrecker. The trucks looked rusted and worn, though they had hedge-cutting blades fixed below the front bumper and iron bars welded across the windshield and windows. Valentine approached the buzz box on the post outside the gate and opened the dirty glass door covering the buttons.
Anything here indicate there's more men here than usual, Rawlings?
No, sir.
You do the talking.
I got a wiring team broken down 3 miles west of here, and I need transport. I'll require one of your trucks and a motorcycle for at least 48 hours.
Yeah, tell it to the Coastal Marines, Sapper.
Is Sergeant Nelson in there?
Who wants to know?
Tell him it's Rawlings, late of the River Road Light. This colonel is steamed, I shit you not, and he's got a brass ring and a crapped out truck full of guys with computers and fiber optic line.
Someone will be out in a moment.
Tell him to make it quick.
I had a harpy swoop overhead not 5 minutes ago. Get out here before the damn thing comes back and shits on me. I hate those fucking things.
I'm gonna need to see some orders and identification.
A corporal and a private approached, looking like they'd just yanked their uniform shirts off of hangers. The shoulders were riding ridged and high. Valentine shoved his ring fist through the bars, waving the ring in their faces.
I've got a broken down truck and a wiring team that's 6 hours late now. Get us the hell inside.
The corporal bussed the ring with his lips. Valentine had made the obeisance often enough during his sojourn as a coastal marine in the Gulf. On a ring belonging to the proper wearer, it gave off a slight tingle.
Not the grog.
Private, you want to speed things up for me? You can have this corporal's stripes. I think by the time I've written my evaluation, he won't need them anymore.
Sir, no disrespect, but I'll get into more trouble by not following procedures than you could ever bring down.
I wonder, you know anything about distributed secure networks?
No, sir.
Then I'll do the thinking here.
All right, sir.
Gas up two trucks, Corporal. Put batteries in or whatever you have to do to get them going.
I thought you said you...
I'm gonna listen to the engines of both. I'll take the truck that sounds healthier.
Valentine shoved past the man and headed toward the main office door between the two bigger buildings. B trailed behind. Two men in undershirts were lacing boots up. There was a duty desk, a mail sorter, and a long bureau with electric coffee pot and pieces of weaponry, lighting, and comm gear wearing yellow toe tags atop it beneath silvery letters reading, Happy New Year. Look alive in 55. There was a sort of wooden loft above with a water tank and boxes of supplies. He had a moment's startle. A shadow above pointed at him with an accusing finger. It turned out to be a mannequin of a nude female with a feather boa.
Where's Sergeant Nelson?
Celebrating in Paducah, sir. They're having fireworks.
Rawlings?
Right here, Major.
That's Colonel, son. I'm not your old CO. You keep forgetting.
Sorry, Colonel.
You know any of these fellas? Who's in charge?
That would be me. What's the emergency, Colonel?
A coarse-looking man emerged from the doorway to what looked like a residence room. He stood in the doorway, a sergeant with a beer gut partially covering a pistol belt. Valentine reached into his attaché and began extracting paperwork and placing it on the duty desk. Then he reached for his gun.
Worse than you know, Sergeant. Sorry to inform you that you're my prisoners. Rawlings, it's a nice-looking .45 the sergeant has on his belt. Relieve him of it. Watch the door, B. Door.
B. Door.
Turn your backs, gentlemen, and place your hands on the back of your head. Fingers interlaced. Kneel.
Shit.
Looks like our ride is up and running. Now, if you're cooperative for the next hour or so, you'll be taken prisoner and brought back to a southern command base. You'll be surprised how nice the day-release POW camps are. If you give us any trouble, I'll leave you tied here for the Reapers. Decision time.
That was the kind of quality manpower that pulled duty on New Year's Eve. Only after Valentine prodded the two corporals with his barrel did the Quislings realize what was going on. He made them the same offer he did the others. They cooperated. The rest of Valentine's team had joined him, Rawlings and B. A few wolves fanned out to both ends of the road for security while the others started looking through the armory. The River Patrol had good gear, including rocket-propelled grenades that Corporal Glass looked over and selected. Valentine found a case of four Type 3s. That had been the weapon issued to his razors by Solon, who'd evidently had a bigger budget than the River Patrol. The small arms were a little disappointing, mostly cut-down versions of the venerable M16. On the other hand, there was a plentitude of small support machine guns that could be carried or fixed to a boat mount. Most of the weapons were packed in protective lubricant. It would take hours to clean them, so the platoon would have to get back with what they brought. They ended up filling two truck trailers with boxes of weapons and ammunition and other assorted pieces of lethality, plus as much comm gear and medicines as they could find. As Valentine and Patel supervised the loading, the assigned drivers checked the tires and tested the lights. The men rode in the beds of the camouflaged service trucks with the prisoners secured to floor bolts. They'd even liberated some walkie-talkies so the drivers could communicate with each other. Condensed and dehydrated foodstuffs and extra gear was piled in bags hanging off the back and strapped to the hoods. They even took the dog. Valentine didn't mind. He liked dogs, though it was heartbreaking if you had to eat them. At the debriefing with Colonel Singh, Gamecock, and other members of the leadership team back at Camp Highbeam, the only person unhappy about the raid was Brother Mark. He looked strained and pale in the fluorescent lighting of the camp classroom that doubled as a conference room. He'd been out on one of his contact trips, negotiating with legworm ranchers, the resistance, and who knew what else.
There is a plan, you know. We don't need to be jamming sticks into the hornet's nest, stirring them up.
One more matter. I wish to intensify training. The whole camp is going to start route marching exercises and war games. The orders and scheduling will be on your desks within 2 days.
Now my bears expect their due.
They're not your bears, Lieutenant Gamecock. They're Southern Command's. They'll get their chance at a short leave. So will all of you. This operation may begin sooner than anyone dreams.
Valentine intercepted Brother Mark as the meeting broke up. It was easy. He wasn't a popular man. Valentine didn't know if it was his fussy manner of speaking or the resentment of soldiers who had to work with a civilian's eye on them.
Excuse me, sir. Were you just with the rebels in the Virginias?
I can't tell you that, son.
Been there, though. You've told us that much.
Yes.
Have you seen the grog that's supposed to be with them? Leading them?
I don't know about leading. They definitely listen to him. He's sort of a mascot or a good luck charm. They always perk up when he's around.
What's he like?
I suspect you know. I was briefed on your trip through Kentucky. Big, leaner, and less stooped over than those thick hides with the fangs. He can speak, too. I've never met a grog who can do that.
The last time you saw him, was he well?
Healthy as a horse. They call him the Uncle, by the way. I just remembered that. He's scarred, but the injuries are healed. Does that put your mind at ease?
I'm very happy to hear that, sir. Thank you.
Happy. I remember that. I'm jealous, son. Excuse me. I must attend to the colonel. Be true.
The brigade made practice marches interspersed with combat training. Jala's command, including Valentine's company, was often matched against the rest of the brigade. After one of these skirmishes, the guard lieutenant colonel, Gage, ordered Valentine to his command car, a beat-up old Humvee with an oversized bed and extra brackets that allowed it to double as an ambulance.
God damn it, Major, our boys are supposed to win. How are they supposed to build confidence when your glorified chicken wranglers burn a couple dozen of them?
Tell your junior officers that just because an area's been checked for mines, it doesn't mean I can't go back and replant after they've been through. My orders were to delay your march on Red Ridge.
You could act a little more like quislings. They always fall back in the face of superior numbers. They don't hunker down and let the first wave get past.
I know, sir.
They still calling you guys the shit detail?
Haven't heard it in a while.
You gotta hand it to you, Valentine. After the last time trying to get at those grogs of yours with the auto 50s, everyone figured we just hadn't run into your boys yet because they hadn't started sniping. Weren't you staff at one time?
Supposed to be. An old ghost caught up to me, and I never made it.
Sorry to boil up on you like that. I'm glad you'll be on our side when we march up country.
As January turned to February, a big duffel bag arrived, labels and identifying inking scrawled all over it. It turned out to be all the way from Pacific Command. Valentine read the letter in the waterproof courier pouch stitched onto the canvas.
Valentine, after many wanderings, your goods surfaced, and I became aware of their existence. I promptly inventoried and dispatched them to Denver, courtesy of a liaison, and I'm confident they'll make it to Southern Command before too many more months pass. Been seeing a lot of your friend Gide. She's got a mouth on her, but she's turning into a deadshot witch of the woods. They're talking about putting me into GHO up here, and if that happens, I might see about a ring for the end of those snake tattoos. She lost 3 toes and a chunk of buttock to a mortar round, so she's off the A active list, but is recovering nicely. She sends a kiss and wants to know if you're still musky. I won't be ungentlemanly and speculate. Please accept your property with my compliments and apologies for the delay. What the hell is that thick leathery material anyway? If you've got any to spare, I'd like some for a jacket. Yours in the cause, Jay LaHave, Colonel Pacific Command.
Valentine's old legworm leathers, gear, and sword had been wrapped up in a waterproof, but someone had made off with his boots, either before it was turned over to LaHave or along the road. Valentine wished their new owner's feet well. The thief, if there had been a thief, missed a stiffened cuirass of cross-grained reaper cloth, light and breathable, and yet strong enough to stop a rifle round. He looked at the sword. Some craftsman had put a new sharkskin grip on it. At least he thought it was sharkskin. It might have been roughed up big mouth, which was just as well, as the old woven one had been getting ragged and bloodstained. He looked closer. There was a tiny little G inked just under the hilt cap next to the stitching. Now that he knew what to look for, he found a similar initial stitched just inside one of the interior side's many map pockets. Nice to have a souvenir of his best memories of the Cascades. Valentine noticed that Guide hadn't returned the old Steyr scout. He didn't regret it. She'd probably make better use of it than he could.